presentation by Peter Arnold and Debbie Wyola. We will have questions, and I'm just going to thank you so much, Gopal. I really appreciate that. So Dr. Peter Arnold is a health economist and senior fellow and director of health policy research at the Political Economy Research Institute in Amherst and a distinguished fellow at the City University of New York Institute for Health Equity. He currently serves on the board of directors of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. And that being said, I'm not a fan of health economists, but I like Peter and Debbie Wyola because, you know what, they think not only with their head, but also with their hearts. And Debbie Wyola is a colleague. She is recently heads up the DRPH program at New York Medical College. And Debbie and I have had the opportunity and the pleasure of working with Debbie for a number of years. And one of the things we believe in is to see, tiny drops of ocean make a mighty tiny drops of water make a mighty ocean. To see how we can help our students understand the importance of socioeconomic inequalities and carry the torch. Peter, the floor is all yours.
Actually, it's
going to be better. Okay. So you're being chivalrous and saying ladies first.
It's a woman's session.
You're a man, Peter, and we have Gopal, and a man is a part of the woman. Go ahead, Debbie.
I can't keep up with those two, so I'm just going to go into it. Peter and I have done this work collaboratively, and we've taken it on the road. It is a local initiative, but we think it has national and global implications, certainly. We presented this at New York State Public Health Association. We're here. We hope to present this in London next year. So it's just been great. It's been tough accommodating the different times, so I'm going to go right into it. Basically, our emphasis is on the aging population based on the work that we do in our affiliations, but also keep in mind that women live longer and women age into poverty. Women carry the greater burden of poverty and age that way, so it also is significant from a woman's health perspective. It is also tied in the food insecurity to the increase in poverty, again, locally, nationally, and globally. It's probably of interest for some of you to realize that even within the United States, 15% of our population are food insecure at any given time, and 6% have very low food security. Numbers-wise, this almost 15% translates into 18 million households or 49 million persons. And I think that's pretty disgustingly significant when you consider that this is data just for the United States. Internationally, of course, the numbers are far greater. The Economic Research Service at the U.S. Department of Agriculture has conducted food surveys of food insecurity in low and middle income countries for many years. In the 76 countries most recently assessed, the total number of food insecure people is estimated at 707 million in 2013 and is expected to increase to 868 million over the next decade. So, you know, our 50 million may not seem like a big block, but it's actually not insignificant when you look at the total number. So food insecurity is part of a larger problem. And actually, Dr. Yamin's presentation, because I work with the human rights framework, I do a lot of work with the aging individuals who are incarcerated, and it dawns on me in the work that we're doing that this whole bit about food insecurity has to do with shortfalls in purchasing power, and this whole power dynamic. I had not really thought about the human rights framework here, and I will when I leave here today, because we have a transferred dependency. A large, significant portion of our population globally, right, if we're going to 868 million, they are dependent on some type of support. And that includes us here, our frail elderly, whether it's even through food stamp program. And so they're always at threat of inadvertent or even intentional, because there's a power struggle here, intentional disruption in those entitlements. And in fact, many of the structural threats to food security, I think, go back to our first presenter, thinking about what are the barriers to providing and empowering women and young girls with education, low labor productivity, widening wage inequality, and we're experiencing that as well in the U.S., asset poverty, which is really more of a problem for women, restricted borrowing capacity, and this is where the whole microfinance world comes in, that Minnie and I have spent some time investigating, and the absence overall of a reliable safety net. So I think actually these are some of the similar issues that my colleagues have mentioned. I do want to throw out there, this is not judgmentally, this is, you know, I'm an economist, I just present data, leave that for other folks to come up with policy, but the U.S. spends in the past decade, our spending on international food aid programs was $2.2 billion. And it is a credit to the Obama administration and through the efforts of Hillary Clinton during her tenure that we definitely had an emphasis on trying to do something to address chronic hunger. But here in the U.S., annual spending on domestic food support programs, and this is largely the SNAP or food stamp program, is $70 billion. So I just wanted to throw that out there. I found that interesting. Our goal here, and Peter's going to present actual results of our study. Our intent at the time, this was a couple of years ago, was to find a study that would contribute to the extant literature of rising food insecurity in the U.S. We found that the elderly actually, surprisingly, is somewhat an understudied population in the U.S. because we focus more on families and children. And we felt that the food insecurity among our oldest residents may be unique because a lot of them live alone, suffer disproportionately from chronic illness, functional impairments, dementia, and of course we know the plight of women as they age. And you'll see in our sample too that roughly I think 60% of our folks are women. So I'll pass this to Peter to present results and come back and probably take the last 2 minutes to bring this into a policy arena. Thank you.
Morning. We're almost done. So a little more about the background of the study. Back in 2008, Goddard Riverside Community Center is a multi-service community-based organization located on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, noticed a huge drop-off in their clients that no longer were receiving home-delivered meals. And this seemed to, they believed it was precipitated by a rule change by the New York City Department for the Aging. And they sought some private funding and to conduct an investigation and to provide meals for those deemed at highest level of food insecurity. The major categories of data collected when we got involved in doing a formal study included demographics, living arrangements, physical and cognitive health, functionality based on activities of daily living, and the ability to live independently based on instrumental activities of daily living, food security, use of paid caregiving, and the use of services and other unmet needs. We adopted the food security scale from the Department of Agriculture, which includes relevant questions from the Current Population Survey's Food Security Supplement. These questions in our assessment tool that serve as the base of food security can be categorized as describing three situations: anxiety or perception that the household food budget or food supply was inadequate, perceptions that food eaten was inadequate quality, or instances or consequences of reduced food intake. Here's a picture of our sample. We to improve the statistical analysis, we oversampled Hispanics and non-Hispanic blacks. So 44% of the respondents were white, 25% black, and 28% Hispanic. As we mentioned, the majority of the frail elderly live alone, and among the 500 seniors that we interviewed, nearly two-thirds were living alone, 59% were women. And the vast majority of the sample was low income. Nearly 90% had income below $25,000 a year. And again, this is New York City. The average age of the people interviewed was 80 years old, and the oldest person in our sample was 109. Our sample, not unlike the majority of seniors in the United States, is not in great health. More than half, or 54%, answered fair or poor when asked to rate their health status, and only 10% reported being in excellent or very good health. We examined self-reported health status by race and ethnicity. In general, whites report better health status than non-Hispanic blacks and Hispanics, but the disparity between Hispanics and non-Hispanics is even wider. Two-thirds of Hispanics report fair or poor health, which is considerably higher than for whites or blacks. Just moving along. So this is, we looked at the delivery of home-delivered meals and looked at their health status, those that received the meals, those that didn't. And as you might expect, those that received home-delivered meals did have higher health food security. But what was interesting is that also had better health status. And so I'll just leave that for now. We looked at the prevalence of chronic disease, and as you might expect, a very high rate, and this is comparable to the data for the United States as well. 89% of our survey respondents had one or more of these six chronic conditions, and two-thirds had two or more of these conditions. The prevalence of chronic diseases was higher and varied by race and ethnicity. It was higher for blacks and Hispanics than for whites. And we looked at the, as I mentioned, the ADLs and the IADLs, and again, very high prevalence of disabled and people that really needed a serious amount of help. So looking at the food security itself, we found, as I mentioned, those that received the home-delivered meals had higher rates of food security, but we found that even among those who received home-delivered meals every single day, about 6% had low or very low food security, or marginal food security. And although these meals are an important source of nutrition for these folks, it may not be, one meal a day may not be sufficient to reduce hunger or anxiety over food availability for all seniors. We looked at unmet needs, a whole range of unmet needs, and we found that about 13% had more than one unmet need, and about 6% had more than two. When we looked at race and ethnicity by unmet needs, again, blacks and Hispanics had higher rates than whites. When we looked at low insecurity by unmet needs, there appears to be a relationship. Those with more than one unmet need had more than three times the rate of low food security compared to those with no unmet needs. And similarly, the sample is similar for those that had home-delivered meals. So I'm going to turn this back now to Deborah to wrap it up on the macro side of poverty. So,
okay. So it's important to bring back what's behind food insecurity, obviously for all groups, and a lot of it has to do with most of these folks have lived within poverty or experienced poverty for most of their life. And what's important here within the U.S., but I think we're also experiencing this in a lot of Western European countries, is there's a more conservative ideology, let's call it, that's influencing governmental decision-making. And so we just heard last Friday, for example, cuts to SNAP or food stamps, which I'll come back to as an example. And when we think about the impact of this past decade, in particular the recessionary period, the financial crisis that occurred in 2007-2008, we're not just talking about our current elderly, but the cohort immediately preceding, the 55 to 64-year-olds, are experiencing unemployment at high levels, won't be reemployed where they were and are actually spending down resources. Traditionally, Black, Hispanics, and of course women have faced higher poverty rates. Women experience almost double of men. But what's very important here is the link between poverty, of course, and health, as we all know, so that the chance of suffering a health condition, acute or otherwise, is almost 55% higher for those who live below the poverty line. Just to give you a sense, and as economists, we'd kind of be remiss if we didn't introduce the supplemental poverty measure, which is a couple of years old, and it's a different way of defining poverty. Very importantly, although it does add back in the value of tax credits and, for example, the value of food stamps you might receive, it also deducts out the out-of-pocket health spending. This measure is very important because, as of 2009, half of seniors in the United States spent at least 16% of their income on health care. So if we look at poverty defined with the supplemental measure, we find that one in seven seniors live in poverty as opposed to one in 10. So, you know, the devil's in the details and how we choose to use them and report them. The share of the elderly with incomes under 200% of poverty is just over a third of the official measure, but becomes one half with the supplemental measure. And that just is my way of saying how important it is. Social Security is for those 65 and over. More than 40% of those currently receiving would have incomes below the federal poverty line. Very important because look at our policies right now and how we're debating cuts to Social Security. So I want to bring it back to food stamps, and why we presented at New York State Public Health Association is our little bit of advocacy would suggest that we have to get more of our seniors into the program. Two out of three seniors who qualify are not receiving benefits, in large part they either don't know about it, there's shame, stigma. This is a generation that it's very tough for them to take a transfer program. And just for our group in New York City, the elderly who do receive this benefit get $111 per month before the cut as of last Friday, which means eating in New York City on less than $4 a day. Okay, so despite some of the rhetoric, it's not exactly the program that you would think it is. So I would like to conclude by taking the Committee on World Food Security's comprehensive framework for action, thinking about some advocacy, thinking about doing things at the local level and building up, and they happened to have met last month, so it was just really good timing. Their framework is expected to enrich the movement for food and nutrition security and help communities build sustainable and resilient livelihoods. But I think we not only should sign Sarah's petition going around, but keep in mind health in all policies. And so a few years ago with David Legg, I did write, and it is in Minnie's book, and I very rarely push anything that I write, but we talk about how neoliberalism, this change to a more conservative ideology, has really impacted our trading policies and agricultural policies and basically how we screw women farmers in developing countries. If that was too blunt, I'm sorry. I guess I've worked with Minnie too long. And that it's very important to... No, that was a compliment. So that was a... So it's an important way of tying this back to health and all policies, which I think we also all embrace and thematically probably a good way to end this discussion in this session. I do want to acknowledge our community partners at Goddard Riverside and Stefan Russo, and also our stats guy who helped us out with some of the number crunching, Ken Knapp, who couldn't join us today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And now I'd like to turn the floor over to questions. We have about 14 and a half minutes.